Targeting, Zionist Israel has so far claimed the lives of more than 37,000 Palestinian martyrs, nearly half of them children. The Palestinian Statistical Center announced that the number of children killed as a result of the Israeli entity genocidal war on Gaza has reached 14,000 children whose lives and dreams will never be fulfilled. Meanwhile, Zionist Israel continues to wipe out entire generations in Gaza, with its soldiers competing to kill the highest number of children, as we all have watched them boast about it on different social media platforms. According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, a child is killed every 15 minutes in the Gaza Strip since the beginning of the war. This large number of casualties comes not only as a result of bombing and aggression, but also starvation, which ranks second in killing children in Gaza. This is due to the Israeli occupation's blockade on the Strip and the prevention of humanitarian food or medical aid from entering the Strip. So far, more than 20 children have been killed due to drought and malnutrition in Gaza. Meanwhile, the occupation war jets and artillery continue their airstrikes and intense shelling on various parts of the Gaza Strip, targeting homes and displaced gatherings, resulting in hundreds of martyrs and wounded. The Zionist occupation forces also persist in their aggression against the Al-Shifa medical complex and its surroundings in western Gaza for a third consecutive week, carrying out executions, arrests, torture, and forced displacement of residents. Experts estimate that the quantity of bombs and explosives dropped on the Gaza Strip since October 7th of last year equals the destructive power of several atomic bombs like those dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, with more than 2,800 massacres in less than 6 months. This leads us to the Zionist doctrine of power, violence, and suicidal deterrence. What cannot be achieved by force is achieved by more force. Through the use of brute force, collective punishment policies, and targeting civilians in their lives and livelihoods, Zionist Israel seeks to push Palestinians towards what resembles learned helplessness. The intention behind this is to divert the thinking of the people under occupation away from the idea of liberation from the occupation, towards completely dismissing the idea of resistance. However, Zionist Israel acknowledges that its success in shaping the awareness of Palestinians remains limited, despite its boasting about its ability to deter states and organizations. Why? Because we are the natives to the land and they are just illegal colonial settlers. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The Israeli entity genocide war against the Gaza Strip continues for its sixth month, characterized in recent days by the continued targeting of hospitals in general and specifically the Al-Shifa hospital, as well as the commission of further atrocities at various levels. Israeli occupation military operations have also been marked by intensified airstrikes on Rafah, hindering aid entry and displacing even more residents. To discuss this issue with us from Damascus is independent journalist and very good friend of mine, Ms. Vanessa Bibi. Thanks a million for being with us. Vanessa, now 6 months into the genocidal Israeli occupation entity's war on the largest concentration camp on earth, which is known as the Gaza Strip, has Zionist Israel succeeded in achieving its aggressive objectives by settler crimes, Judaization, massacres, genocide, and ethnic cleansing?
No, absolutely not. In fact, the Zionist entity is losing on all fronts in the northern occupied territories. As we know, an estimated 100,000 settlers and various Zionist businesses have been forced out of that territory and to relocate to the south. And it's admitted even by the Zionist entity that it's very unlikely that there will be enough security for them to return. We know that the entire resistance axis, including, of course, Yemen, has shut down the arterial shipping lane, and that now Eilat, the southern port in the occupied territories, is being targeted on a very regular basis. In Gaza itself, and even in the West Bank, the Zionist entity has met, what is effectively a besieged, starved, deprived resistance with relatively small capability, and yet they're unable to defeat them on the ground. They can only take power, let's say, by bombing women and children and schools and hospitals and summarily executing unarmed and defenseless civilians on an almost hourly basis. The Israeli economy is on its knees. The morale within the military is also decimated. And they're facing a united resistance axis that has never been seen before, actually. And so in my opinion, despite the horrors that we're seeing, as I said, on an hourly basis, particularly in Gaza, but also in West Bank, the Zionist entity is losing this war, even on the propaganda front. Their entire edifice of lies and victimhood has been eradicated.
Mm-hmm. Well, Vanessa, the historic epic battle inscribed by the Palestinian resistance in the Battle of the Al-Aqsa Flood Operation on October 7 has been deemed as one of the most persistent lies so far in the Zionist propaganda machine by the supporters of this genocidal Israeli entity as the main reason, the Al-Aqsa Flood Operation being the main reason behind the calamity that has surpassed so far the 1948 Nakba, by the way, with numbers and statistics. Look, I myself am tired of repeating the history for the people who refuse to acknowledge the right of resistance, the right of return, the right to people to live in peace in their own land. I'm not going to talk about that anymore, but if I am tired, do you think that the people who are actively under genocide that we are watching in real time on TV and on our smartphones, do you think that they have, the Zionists have completely decimated the last shred of determination the hearts and souls and minds of those people?
I think if anything, what they've done is to strengthen the resolve. Of course, as I've said before, it's heartbreaking to see the images that are coming out of Gaza of starving children, of children that have been completely orphaned, eviscerated, lost legs, arms, limbs, etc. But if I speak to, for example, even the few friends of mine that I've managed to stay in contact with that are now in Rafah, there is no intention to leave Gaza despite the hardship that they're enduring. And in reality, what has the Zionist entity done? It's created an entire new generation of resistance, but not only among Palestinians, throughout the populations of the world. Because even those Arab states that have normalized relations with Israel, that have effectively tried to alleviate the pressure on Israel since the 7th of October, even in those countries, the populations are against their government's policy. Look at the protests that are now spreading across the Middle East, but across the entire world. So what the Zionist entity has actually done is to raise awareness in the world of the Palestinian issue, put it back on a world stage, and turn, you know, if you really want to be honest, we are all Hamas, we are all the resistance, mm-hmm. because the Zionist entity is exposed for its sadistic, savage, brutal policy, not only in Palestine, regionally and globally.
Well, Vanessa, for two decades, we have seen the Zionist Israeli entity erecting the apartheid separation wall, which separates its colonies from the West Bank, for example, after seizing much of the West Bank's land, restricting the movement of the natives inhabited, the native inhabitants in the West Bank, and turning their lives practically into just a living hell. The International Criminal Court of Justice ruled that that wall is illegitimate and it should be removed. Nothing changed. It also ruled that it's basically on the verge of ruining that what's happening in Gaza is a genocide. And nothing happened. And the UNSC issued a resolution for a temporary ceasefire. Nothing again happened. What are the options left after all of this Zionist aggression and global disregard of what's going on in Palestine?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we've seen to some degree a bit of a circus between the U.S. and the Zionist entity. We've seen recently Netanyahu, Hubris, really isolating the Zionist entity even more from its global supporters, from its support base. But despite all of that, of course, the U.S. and the U.K. and the EU nations that are embedded with Israel for various reasons have still been supplying the weapons and the bombs and the armaments that are on a daily basis massacring Palestinian people and children. And the numbers that we're hearing, in my opinion, are way lower than they are in reality. We know that these organizations like the UN massage and manipulate numbers in order to serve the agenda of those that have actual control of them. You know, the international community, such as it is, whether it's the UN Security Council, the UNGA, the ICJ, are powerless because they're under the control of the West and of its Zionist Frankenstein. The only option now is for the resistance. And we're seeing already that Israel, in order to survive in the region, is expanding the war in the region. It's bombed Syria in the last 3-4 days, every single day, targeting Hezbollah positions, targeting development centers, etc. They want to and they need to expand the war in order to survive, because they're not going to survive as they are. And so now it becomes an issue of the resistance strategy to prevent the final solution, as the Zionists call it, in Gaza and in the West Bank.
Well, I share your sentiment to what's going on, and am very invested in how the world will react, if they will ever react, to any upcoming invasion of Rafah, and how the resistance will react, because that's what we are counting on right now. Thank you very much, independent journalist Vanessa Beely from Damascus, for joining us to discuss this issue. Now, ladies and gents, stay with us, because we will next be talking about how the Palestinian people themselves are still actively supporting the resistance.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
A poll conducted by a leading Palestinian Institute for Opinion Polling showed that more than half of Palestinians believe that Hamas should govern the Gaza Strip once the current war ends, while only 11% want Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas to manage the territory. More details in the following report.
Over 50% of Palestinians, according to an opinion poll by a prominent Palestinian research institute, believe that Hamas should be in charge of the Gaza Strip after the current genocide ends. The Palestinian Center for Political and Survey Research, PCPSR, in Ramallah published the results last week in collaboration with the Conrad and Denor Foundation. Amid growing international concern over the increasing number of Palestinian civilian casualties as a result of the Israeli entity war against Gaza, now entering its sixth month. 59% of respondents in Gaza and the occupied West Bank said they wanted the Palestinian resistance Hamas to manage the Gaza Strip after the war. Only 13% of respondents hoped for the Palestinian Authority to return to control the sector, but under a different leadership than Mahmoud Abbas. The 88-year-old has seen a decline in popularity in recent years due to his failure to advance Palestinians' hopes of establishing a state and his reluctance to mend relations with the other Palestinian resistance factions, most notably Hamas. There have also been no substantive negotiations with the occupation for over a decade, where the Palestinian Authority is widely seen by its people as increasingly corrupt and autocratic. Simply because Abbas, who was elected for a 4-year term in 2005, has not yet appointed a successor and refuses to go to elections. According to the survey conducted between March 5 and 10, which included a sample of approximately 1,580 adult Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied West Bank, 70% of respondents said they were satisfied with the role of the Palestinian resistance faction Hamas played during the war. Additionally, 61% approved of the role played by Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in Gaza. The survey also found that 71% of Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank believed that the Al-Aqsa flood operation on October 7th was a correct decision, representing only a 1% decrease according to a previous survey conducted by the organization and published in December. Furthermore, according to the survey, nearly 70% of Palestinians called for the dissolution of the Palestinian Authority. Additionally, 90% of Palestinians believe that President Mahmoud Abbas should resign. The survey also showed an increase in the percentage of support for armed resistance to confront the occupation, with more than 60% of Palestinians surveyed believing that resistance is the optimal way to end the occupation. The survey results indicate widespread frustration towards the international community, especially the United States of America and major European countries, and even the United Nations, which pressed for an immediate ceasefire for humanitarian reasons in Gaza, and yet Zionist Israel continues its genocide unabated.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Perth is geopolitical commentator Ms. Maram Susli. Thanks a million for being with us, Maram, to discuss this issue. Now, an opinion poll, as you know, among Palestinians showed an increase in support of the Palestinian resistance Hamas in the Gaza Strip, which is facing ongoing Israeli entity genocidal aggression. How do you explain this to Western audiences who are completely brainwashed by Zionist propaganda with all this genocidal violence? Palestinians must have rejected Hamas by now, but the opinion polls say otherwise. How do you explain this to them?
Well, you know, the purpose of Israel's assault on Gaza, number one, is to commit a genocide and push the Palestinians out. But the other is their hope to destroy the support base of the resistance by, punishing the people of Palestine for the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. Mm-hmm. But it seems that this hasn't actually worked. And, you know, in the West, they claim to support democracy, but when it comes to the opinion of Middle Easterners who voted in, for example, in Gaza, they voted in Hamas, mm-hmm. they don't sort of respect those opinions. So they really only respect opinions that the State Department of the United States says is acceptable. Mm-hmm. I would explain it this way. You know, the fact of the matter is that the Palestinians have been suffering long before October 7th from the Israeli aggression, the terrorist actions of the Zionists. And, of course, they're going to support the only people who, rather than dying on their knees, will stand up and fight on their feet. And in spite of, the genocide of the Israelis are committing, the resistance isn't being blamed for that by the people.
Mm-hmm. But Madam, the propaganda machine of the West keeps saying that it is basically the killing of 1,700 Israelis that triggered all of this. How do you respond?
Well, you know, in 2023 alone, there was already 800 Palestinians that were killed, 400 in Gaza alone. In the West Bank, the Israelis shot a two-year-old in the head just because he was part of the Tamimi family, which is a family that is very good at resistance. So, you know, the notion that the reality started in October 8th is really the notion that only Jewish lives matter and Palestinian lives are irrelevant. Mm-hmm. And of course, this has been going since even before 1948, when someone had the bright idea to create something called Israel. The terrorist attacks by the two terrorist groups that became the IDF, Ergon, Lehi, and Haganah, they were killing Palestinians even before Israel was created. Mm-hmm. So, of course, it didn't start in 1948.
Well, Madam, it was not a surprise for anyone who has been following Palestinian politics for the past two decades at least that the poll showed an overwhelming rejection of Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, with nearly 90% of those who took the poll said that he should resign. Yet, we see that the Biden administration, we see regional normalizing regimes, including the PA and Mahmoud Abbas, in every step of the so-called ongoing ceasefire negotiations. I mean, are they delusional, thinking that the PA can actually have any power inside of Gaza, or are we missing something here?
The fact that the PA even is playing along with the notion that they will take power in Gaza is an act of treason, in my opinion, and also probably in the opinion of many Palestinians who will outright reject this. The reason why the PA is no longer getting any support is because it's very clear that the two-state solution is dead, and that's their entire thing that they're based on, is pushing for peaceful resolution. But Netanyahu has made it clear over the last several decades that he has no intention of ever creating a Palestinian state. And the genocide in Gaza has only really stuck the final nail in the coffin of that delusion. Of course, the people are not are seeing that. And it's not only that the two-state solution is dead, but even the one-state solution is on its death knell at this point. It's clear from the genocide that Zionism just has no place in our region, in the Levant, and it simply has to go.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, all the possible solutions that are being presented by the State Department, by the Secretary of State, by the Secretary of Defense, or what we call the War Minister in the U.S., or in other Arab normalizing regimes, is based on the fact that they don't want to see Hamas in Gaza anymore. Whose decision is it, Maram?
Well, it's really the decision of the people. And it's interesting when, the fact is that even in the West Bank, the opinion polls show that Hamas has become more popular than the PA. So perhaps Hamas should be governing the West Bank as well. So it just goes to show you that these people think that they can dictate to Palestinians what they should have. And when we talk about normalizing regimes, we're talking really about Saudi Arabia, because they were about to sign the Abraham Accord just before October 7th happened. And what's interesting is that even inside Saudi Arabia, a December 2023 poll showed that support for Hamas jumped by 30%.
Mm-hmm.
So it went up substantially after October 7th.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's going to be a hard sell for Saudi Arabia, which is not a democracy in the first place.
Taken from what you are telling us, Maram, and according directly to the results of the survey conducted by the Palestinian Center for Political and Survey Research in Ramallah, they said that support for Hamas in the West Bank alone tripled compared to before the war. And that's just a survey that's done on a regional, on a national scale. It's done on a regional scale for Arab world or for the Muslim world. But let us say with the Arab world, if it's done inside of the Arab world and we ask the same questions, it would be a sweeping result in favor, in support of Hamas. Where did the Western Zionist Israel go wrong here when it came to at least controlling the narrative?
You know, that's actually very interesting. The poll I was talking about with Saudi Arabia was a Washington Institute poll. So it was conducted by the Americans, and that showed a three times jump in support for Hamas since October 7th. And I think that the reason is that, you know, in the past when we've seen Hamas conduct attacks against Israelis, it's really been like superficial. They haven't really have been effective. But this time there was a real, like they really showed themselves to be a resistance organization. And a lot of that is because of the of backing by Iran rather than Qatar. Qatar was trying to turn Hamas into sort of a PA where they just pay them off and in order for them to never fight the Israelis, who are constantly pretending under the table or in whispers that they might be talking of peace. But while they talk of peace, of course, they plan for war. And the people are not blind. They know what's up. And, you know, the notion that the Americans think that they can subdue the Palestinians and their opinion by brute force and bombs is the miscalculation here. Because they thought if they could destroy and demolish Gaza, that it would turn the Palestinians and the region against Hamas. And that's just not what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, we still have one more minute, Maram. And I think that the upcoming stage is a very vital, important stage for the Palestinian cause, given that everyone who is supporting, really supporting Palestine, is also under heavy blows and airstrikes by the Zionist entity. But it is the first time that we see this kind of a scale of support for Palestine. Do you think that this would change at least the minds of those who were against Syria, against Hezbollah, against Iraq, against Yemen for the past at least 11 years?
You know, a lot of those people are kind of silent right now and sheepish. And I think that opinion polls have, inside the region at least, have become a lot more positive of the Houthis, of Iran. And this is a mask-off moment for those in the region that pretend to be supportive of the Palestinian cause, but are in fact doing nothing for them. For example, Erdogan's Turkey, Qatar as well, Saudi Arabia. You know, these people are supposed to be the Islamic world, and yet they have shown themselves to be complete and utter gutless traitors. So in contrast to that, Iran, with the support of the resistance axis, is undoubtedly going to gain support. Unfortunately, you know, in the West, you have the liberals who are in control of a lot of the pro-Palestinian groups who do want to push out, like, real resistance towards Israel, which is very interesting because, you know, it's almost like they are, by design, being controlled opposition. Mm. But even these voices are becoming more and more ostracized, with the reality on the ground being that the resistance is serious about fighting Zionism.
And that's what we count on, Maram, 100%, the people and the resistance on the ground always and forever. And well, thank you very much, Maram Susli, for being with us, geopolitical commentator from Perth, to discuss these growing support for the resistance all across the region, not only in Palestine. Thank you very much for being with us. Ladies and gents, thank you for watching the Middle East stream right here on Press TV. Please do follow us on Telegram and on X. And we promise to give you the latest always from here from West Asia in support always for the resistance and the people, native people of the resistance. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Donald Trump has posted a $175 million bond in his New York civil fraud case as he appeals the court's decision. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster ABC News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump and his co-defendants have secured a $175 million bond in their New York civil fraud case, according to court filing. Donald Trump secured the bond through Knight Specialty Insurance Company, which is owned by the privately held Hanke Group, whose chairman told ABC News that he considers himself a Donald Trump supporter. "This is what we do at Knight Insurance, and we're happy to be able to accommodate the ex-president in this situation," Don Hanke told ABC News. He added, "I'd say it's more of a business decision, but I happen to be a supporter also." Don Hanke said his company was initially involved in talks to underwrite the original $464 million bond in the case. Then when a New York appellate court last week reduced the amount to $175 million, Hanke said his company renewed their effort to underwrite the bond. "It was a relatively low number and Donald Trump put up all the collateral in cash," Don Hanke said. Hanke could not recall if Donald Trump also used bonds as collateral for the finalized bond, noting that his company reviewed some of the former president's bonds, which he said were as grade A bonds, investment grade quality securities. "We're confident that we have very good collateral," Hanke added. Hanke told ABC News that he has contributed to the former president's campaign, but could not recall the amount that he had donated to Trump's campaign. An official with the New York Attorney General's office declined to comment to ABC News. As promised, President Trump has posted the bond. His attorney, Alina Haber, said in a statement on Monday evening, 1st of April. He looks forward to vindicating his rights on appeal and overturning this unjust verdict. Last week, a panel of judges from New York's Appellate Division granted the former president, his adult sons, and two former Trump Organization executives a 10-day stay of the $464 million judgment in their civil fraud case and permitted them to post a reduced bond of just $175 million. Trump's lawyers had argued that the former president lacked the cash to secure a bond for the full judgment after being rejected by more than 30 bond companies. Without intervention from an appeals court, defense lawyers argued that Trump would suffer irreparable harm by having to sell off his namesake properties before he exhausted his appeal of the fraud ruling. In February, following a three-month trial, Judge Arthur Engoron fined Donald Trump and his co-defendants after finding they had engaged in a decades-long business fraud by falsely inflating the former president's net worth to get better loans and business deals. Judge Engoron said, "The frauds found here leap off the page and shock the conscience." Trump has denied all wrongdoing and his lawyers have appealed the ruling in the case, arguing that the disgorgement amount was unconstitutional, disproportionate and flawed. Defense lawyers argued that Judge Engoron misapplied the statute of limitations for Trump's conduct and the New York Attorney General Letitia James failed to prove Donald Trump's misrepresentations were relevant to the former president's lenders. There is no evidence and no finding by Supreme Court that the relevant lenders and insurance would not have given defendants loans and policies on the same terms in the absence of the supposed misrepresentations, defense lawyers said in a March filing. If their appeal fails, the former president and his co-defendants will be on the hook for the entire $464 million judgment. If Trump does not have the cash to cover the full judgment and his appeal is unsuccessful, Letitia James could enforce the judgment by seizing Donald Trump's assets. If he does not have funds to pay off the judgment, then we will seek judgment enforcement mechanisms in court, and we will ask the judge to seize his assets, Letitia James said in a recent interview with ABC News. The cable news network CNN has also covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump has posted a $175 million bond as he appeals the judgment against him in the New York civil fraud case brought by State Attorney General Letitia James. Donald Trump's bond pauses any action that Letitia James could take against Trump's properties in response to the judgment until at least September, when the state appeals court also set a schedule to hear his appeal for the $464 million verdict against him. The bond is underwritten by Knight Specialty Insurance, a Los Angeles, California-based insurance company, but the court document does not list the collateral that Donald Trump has used to secure the bond. Last month, Trump said at a news conference he would use cash to cover the bond, but claimed that he also wanted to use cash to fund his re-election campaign. Yet, asked if he planned to start personal funds into his presidential campaign, Donald Trump said, "First of all, it's none of your business." He added, "I might do so. I have the option." The bond amount was lowered by several hundred million dollars by a state appeals court last month after Donald Trump's attorneys argued that covering the full bond on the $464 million verdict against him was not feasible. Donald Trump himself was ordered to pay $454 million. The $464 million includes the disgorgement for his two sons, Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump. In January, Judge Arthur Engoron fined Trump and his co-defendants, including his adult sons and his company, $464 million, finding they fraudulently inflated the value of the former president's assets to obtain better loan rates. Trump has been given 30 days to post the bond for the full amount of the judgment while he appealed, as is required by state law, but his attorney said he could not find an insurance company to underwrite that large bond. That prompted New York State Attorney General Letitia James to take steps to prepare to seize Donald Trump's assets in the event that Trump failed to post the bond. When the 30-day deadline hit, however, the New York Appeals Court stepped in and lowered the bond to just $175 million, giving Trump an additional 10 days. As promised, former President Trump has posted the bond. Trump's attorney, Alina Haber, said in a statement. Haber added, he looks forward to vindicating his rights on appeal and overturning this unjust verdict. Donald Trump has also posted a $91.6 million bond last month in the E. Jean Carroll defamation case, while he appeals that verdict against him.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawbid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
My pleasure. Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
You're welcome. We are still actually in the month of Ramadan, this blessed month of God, in which we try to, in fact, touch on some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and the month of Ramadan. Well, and one of those important concepts that come about, is especially at the beginning or end of each month, is the sighting of the crescent, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, people, in fact, actually stare at the sky to see or to sight whether they can see the crescent of the previous month or the next or the future month, right?
Yes.
So that they can determine whether it is the end of the month or the beginning of the month. And usually we come about or we face three categories, three situations,
sure,
three scenarios. One of them is that the crescent, the moon crescent, in fact, sets in before the sunset. And one scenario is that both of them can be seen up in the sky. And the other one is that the crescent, in fact, sets after the sunset. Would you talk about all of these cases and how whether it is enough, actually, or which one of these scenarios would help us, determine the end and the beginning of the month?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, as you rightly mentioned, the issue of establishing the crescent of the month of Ramadan is a very critical issue begins with in the end or in the beginning of the month, maybe especially in the month of Ramadan, when people want to establish the moon and sight it with their eyes or without with or with equipments. Anyhow, when it comes to the question you raised, whether the moon can be seen before the sunset or during the sunset or after the sunset, of course, in all the three cases, sighting the crescent, is enough to be established. Mm-hmm. If it is sighted any time around the sunset, before it, after it, or maybe during the sunset, it is considered as sufficient, and the start of the lunar month is established.
Mm-hmm, I see. One of the other questions comes to the mind of our dear audience might be, using some kind of technological advancement.
Yes.
If we use, for example, something like binoculars or telescope or whatever, is that okay? I mean, is it all right to use these tools in order to sight the crescent?
Yeah. Well, this is a very contentious issue because the scholars, the religious authorities are somehow polarized around this issue. Because they differ in their opinions among themselves. And some scholars are of the view that we should not use binoculars, telescopes, and the likes to establish the beginning of the month, of the lunar month, and some others quite support these devices, saying there's no problem as long as, as you are using these items and the beginning of the month is established, so there's no objection. So as we can see, we have to with regard to the opinion of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may he live long, of course he is of the view that the sighting of the new crescent with these instruments can be established because they are reliable tools. And the ruling does not differ from that of the naked eyes. If you cannot see with the naked eye, the moon or the crescent, there is no objection to you take up, for example, binoculars and see and look for the crescent in the sky or in the horizon to find it.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
Ya Allah, thank you for another chance standing at my door. Ya Allah, you've given me hope, delivered this gift right to my home. Marhab, marhab, ya Ramadan, ahi qulub بنا بالقرآن حل ليالنا بالقيام أهلا أهلا بالصيام.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIP English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the month of Ramadan and fasting. Sheikh Javid, we are talking about the crescent and the different scenarios that are available in order to, for example, mark the end of Ramadan and the beginning of the next month, which is Shawwal, right?
Yes.
So if the local people cannot see or cannot sight the moon, basically, but the radio or television announces the beginning of Shawwal for that particular day, right?
Yeah.
Like we usually call it the Yom Shak, right?
Yes.
That whatever translation which is available for that, a dubious day or whatever. So people have doubts.
Yes.
Whether that day is particularly the end of Ramadan or the beginning of Shawwal, what should they do in that scenario?
I believe it depends largely on where we live, whether we live in countries like Pakistan or mm-hmm. Iran, or we live in Arab countries like the UAE or Qatar or Saudi Arabia. So those countries actually have their own method of establishing the beginning of the month of Shawwal, and the Islamic Republic of Iran has its own special method. So I think we cannot say that when the announcement is made by a government, then we have to act according to the announcement. Like in Saudi Arabia, we see that they announce the Eid day sometimes even one day before, sometimes before the announcement made by the Islamic Republic of Iran. So I think it is necessary to make sure that the moon has been sighted, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because the Shia scholars unanimously believe that the moon has to be sighted, mm-hmm. okay? While some of the Arab countries in the region do not go for that, they do not believe that the moon has to be sighted, because they think that the moon is there but it is not visible. It's hiding somewhere behind in the horizon, so we cannot find it. So when 29 days or 30 days have passed, they begin breaking their fast and declaring the Eid day.
That's so the case. Visibility of the crescent or the sighting of the moon or crescent is not a must for them.
For them, yes. But for us, it's a must. We must be sure that the moon has been sighted, either by way of a telescope or by binoculars or any other devices.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, everybody has to follow his own mujtahid when it comes to mm-hmm. this issue especially.
Yes.
So, for example, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that, okay, devices such as telescope and, mm-hmm. binoculars are enough.
Mm-hmm.
But some other religious scholars who live or who sit in the holy city of Najaf are of the view that no, these are not these should not involve the sighting of the moon should not involve these devices, instruments. Rather, the moon has to be sighted and established with the naked eyes.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and the month of Ramadan. Sheikh Javid, I was talking about the sighting of the moon, and if it is difficult to ascertain the beginning of, for example, the month of Ramadan, or the end of it, like Eid al-Fitr,
yes,
all right, which is the beginning of the next month, which is Shawwal. Well, because of inability, for example, to observe or to sight the crescent, all right, whether at the beginning of the month or the end of the next month, due to, for example, some climate conditions, like, for example, clouds, all right,
yes,
which makes it impossible, in fact, for people on the earth to sight the crescent, right? If you live, for example, in Japan,
yes,
let's say, all right, can you, or is it permissible for those people, for the Muslims in Japan, to go by the horizon of the Middle East, like Iran, for example?
Well,
what should they do? What's the rule?
Well, the horizon, these two countries, like for example Iran and Japan, do not seem to have the same horizon, because Japan is many thousand miles away from Iran, and in the eye of custom, of course, they do not seem to have the same horizon. When the moon is sighted there, it doesn't mean that it will be sighted here in Iran. So people in those countries, in for example in Japan, as you gave the example, can follow their own horizon, and the people in the Middle East should have their own horizon, and they do have it, but they cannot start fasting or break their fast relying on the horizon of Japan.
So you mean there is a condition which needs to be met, and that is the sameness of the horizon. Sameness of horizon. Would you talk a little about this? We don't have much time.
The sameness of horizon, it means to be equal as far as the possibility and impossibility of sighting the moon crescent is concerned. When it comes to the possibility of sighting the moon.
How many miles or kilometers are we talking about?
We are not, talking in terms of miles or kilometers, probably it could be many hundred miles, but it has something to do with the possibility and impossibility of actually sighting the moon in that horizon by people or from both, let's say, countries or regions or areas.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Shashogi. And thank you, my dear listeners, for joining your own program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio, in which we try to touch on some of the jurisprudential laws related to fasting and the month of Ramadan, and in particular, we talked about sighting of the crescent. Thank you. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Oh Allah, please unite us and guide us to paradise. Oh, and guide us to paradise. Ramadan is here, Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show.
Hustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. please refer to our website for the details.
Flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night. While the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. Through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down Gaza tonight. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in the night without a fight. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.